Basically, I've been having dinner with causality every day of my life for the last 15 years or so.
If it's not an experiment or a quasi experiment, I don't even want to hear about it.
And you've been brainwashing me.
A little bit.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, friends. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Welcome to the show. You just heard the fiery married couple, economist Ioana Marinescu, and old friend of the show, neuroscientist Conrad Curding. And they just published a paper with Patrick Lawler in Nature Human Behavior about ways to infer causality in quasi-experiments. So quasi-experiments are experiments in which subjects or conditions aren't randomly assigned to groups, but we discuss this deeper in the show. Ioana and Conrad are both professors at the University of Pennsylvania. Ioana is an economist, and to get a flavor from where she's coming from, we chat about two of her interests, universal basic income and monopsony. And this was my first exposure to the word and concept of monopsony, the definition of which is a market situation in which there is only one buyer. So thanks, Ioana, for expanding my horizons. And Conrad, you may remember, is a neuroscientist. He has done a lot of work in computational neuroscience, but recently has become really interested in causality, hence this paper. So we talk about causality in general and how economists have this quasi-experiment process all figured out and have for quite some time. And the fundamental problem of constructing a counterfactual in determining causality. A counterfactual is something that would have happened under different circumstances. We talk about the value of correlational studies and how they can complement causal studies. And we briefly cover two of the three methods described in their paper to determine causality in these quasi-experiments. And here's a little preview of one of those methods, called the difference in differences.
So differences in differences comes from the following idea.
In a difference in difference.
Differences in differences.
The gap or difference. Difference in differences.
The idea of different diff.
The difference. A difference in differences. This difference would stay constant. In difference in differences.
Differences in differences.
So the difference between two change. That's one difference.
All right. Got it. So, plenty of causality talk today. And later I asked them both about the right balance between collaborating and exploring other fields versus focusing deeply in one's own topic and field. And they have insightful responses, as you'll hear. They give advice on how to do Twitter. Here's one tip, don't respond to the trolls. And of course, we talk about a lot more. To learn more or connect with Ioana or Conrad on Twitter, you'll hear they have this Twitter battle going on. You can find Ioana at MIoana, that is M-I-O-A-N-A, and Conrad is at Curding Lab, that is K-O-R-D-I-N-G Lab, Curding, spelled with an O. Or you can find those links and more in the show notes, braininspired.co/podcast/27. If you're so inclined, you can support me on Patreon, like Zach, John, and Minsuk did this past week. Thank you, guys. I am now up to about $2 per day so far, which sounds small, but it's awesome nonetheless. You can find out how to do that on the website at braininspired.co. Now, I forced these two lovebirds, Ioana and Conrad, to play the newlywed game toward the end of the show, and it's tough. Because, as you may know, I'm highly trained in marital counseling. But these two, I mean, well, you'll see. Ioana Marinescu and Conrad Curding here with me today. Welcome, guys. And you're joint, you're sitting right next to each other. So welcome to the show.
Yay! Hello, everyone.
Great to see you.
Good to see you again, Conrad. So you've been on before. You are a professor at UPenn, and from the last time I spoke with you, Some people do listen to the podcast. I had an old friend who was in the administrative department at Northwestern, and she said, oh man, because she enjoyed the episode, and she said, I was really sad to see Conrad go. And she said, but I feel really happy for him because I think that we didn't have what it took here for his collaborative style. So I'm glad that he's getting that at UPenn. So anyway, she's happy for you. So I can kind of reintroduce you. You know, your research has gone from computational neuroscience through some degrees of change. Now you're doing more of an engineering and data science approach. And really now you're interested in this question of causality in modern experiments without randomized controls. And Ioana, you're an assistant professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania as well. And you're also a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And you specialize in things like universal basic income, monopsony, which is the first time I had heard of that word. She gives two thumbs up. Okay. Unemployment insurance, employment contracts, and on. So this is a first for me that I have two guests on the show. And this is a different kind of show. So actually, you guys heard of my reputation, and I understand that you sought me out for some marriage counseling.
Will we still be allowed to continue collaborating after you're through with it?
We'll see. So I understand, Ioana, you don't think Conrad is good enough with money. And Conrad, you don't think that Ioana collaborates enough. And so we're going to get to the heart of these issues here today. How long have you guys been married?
15 years.
Almost, yeah.
That's twice as long as me. So maybe if we get time for it later, we might do something fun. Have you heard of the Newlywed Game?
No.
Yeah, it's an old program, I guess, from the United States.
We aren't exactly newlywed anymore. But
we may play the Newlywed Game to conjure those, rekindle those spirits, perhaps, later.
All right.
Let's go for it later.
But for now, we'll just ask one real marriage question here. So, Ioana, what is one special talent that Conrad has that most people might not know about?
He's an excellent cook.
Oh, okay. Very good. Okay, Conrad. Question goes to you now. What's one special talent that Ioana has?
Ioana is an outstanding salsa dancer.
Salsa dancer. Oh, wow. The hips. Okay, good. Maybe maybe I can get a demonstration of both of those sometime. But you guys, so you've been married for 15 years. That means you suffered from the two-body problem in academia.
Oh, yeah.
Have you struggled with that? Has that been easy? Because I personally know some people that it's been a struggle for.
It's difficult, no?
I think it's extremely difficult, and we've been extremely lucky. So, for example, in our first job search, when we were both looking for our first faculty jobs, literally, Conrad had one job offer.
Uh-huh.
The only job offer he had was in the same city that I was
wow.
in. And it was independent. You know, there was no direct connection. So, you know, what's the probability, you know, like it's just something that shows you how hard it is, because it's really not a given that this would happen. So I think, you know, it's extremely difficult, but I will say, you know, once we were looking again more recently, it's been easier, still not easy, but you know, once you're more established, you're a known quantity that departments, you know, have some knowledge of, and they're well aware of two-body problems and more willing to work with you. I feel as once you're established, you know, your career and your contribution to the field, it's a little easier. Though still not easy. We have some friends who've been living apart, have a kid and living apart for years in two excellent universities, very far away from each other.
Yeah.
So it's... you know, we've been very lucky.
That was my example,
yeah.
too, is I know a couple, and they have a child, and well, they have multiple children, and she had an accident where she was, like, her lower half was paralyzed, and she was having to learn how to rewalk, and they were in separate cities, so it was just a big mess, you know.
You know, what would you not sacrifice for the beauty of academia and science?
Oh, back to the marriage counseling, I see.
No, but the amazing thing is these people, these friends of ours certainly make it work really amazingly, you know, and my brother-in-law, kind of similar situation.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who make it work, but for me, being with Ioana is very important, so
We just have to say gratitude to the universe.
Oh, yeah. I bet there is a lot of gratitude when it works out like that. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're going to talk about causality and your newest paper, but, we've never talked about economic issues on the podcast. Not that the podcast is about economic issues, but just to give people a sense of where you're coming from, can we just talk for a moment about universal basic income and maybe monopsony? So universal basic income, should we all just move to Alaska or what?
So, I think for the audience here, you might have heard about AI and how potentially this will make all jobs disappear. I think this is highly uncertain. And, this is something that you can debate because we've had a lot of other technological changes in the past that have ultimately led to more work, arguably, for people and a higher standard of living. So is this time different? Who knows? We are not, experts at predicting big things like that. But it's certainly a risk, I would argue. And I think in the face of that, someone like me who studies labor markets and also systems of social insurance, the big question is, how do we insure ourselves against some bad outcomes that could happen? And so, basic income is one of the proposals that's been floating around in thinking about what we might do if indeed jobs were becoming increasingly hard to find, at least for some people. And especially in this country, a lot of the benefits that you get are dependent on you having a job. Mm. If you don't have a job, you might be disqualified for many benefits. So what if it was really for no fault of your own, you couldn't get a job? So that's why I became interested in looking at this basic income and an economist. I'm interested in, maybe using that to fix the labor market, but some people say it could do harm because if you give people money for nothing, maybe they won't be working.
Right.
Right. So that's really
They could turn lazy.
Exactly.
Do they turn lazy?
Well, not really. That's what we find by looking at Alaska that has had something similar to basic income since 1982. And this is where actually we're using a quasi-experimental method. Uh-huh. We haven't actually discussed this one explicitly in our paper, but it's one of those classes of quasi-experimental methods that's kind of similar to what we do discuss, which is difference in differences, sort of. Hmm. So anyway, we find that Alaska basically has an employment level that is similar to other states that can plausibly be controls and that didn't have this policy. Huh. So therefore, in terms of the impact of a basic income style policy where every Alaskan receives this payment every year, no strings attached, doesn't have an impact on the share of Alaskans that work. So, that's, a big finding from my recent work about UBI and understanding what it could do to the labor market, some of the unintended consequences, which in this particular case doesn't really materialize.
Right. And I understand that it's supported by both main political parties in the United States, or at least in principle.
Right. I mean, there's some support from both conservatives and progressives for slightly different reasons, in the sense that, on the progressive side, it's obviously the idea of income security is very important to progressives. And the more conservative side, there's also, I think for everyone's idea of insurance, it's quite important, to give people some last resort level of income security. But on the conservative side, the basic income is especially attractive because of its simplicity and its freedom enhancing qualities, in the sense that it has no conditions. So you don't need to be tracked. You don't need to be checked. We don't need to look at your income, your family situation, your health status. You get it no matter what. And that, in a sense, is very freedom friendly. Mm. It's like you don't need to do anything. You just get it and then you do anything you want with it. So for the more, pro-market libertarians, this is a very appealing proposition from that perspective, that it really very much fosters individual freedom.
It seems like I've heard more and more about universal basic income recently. And what is your gut feeling on the trajectory of the possibility of this becoming a national policy ever? I know you think that it's better on the state level, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's something that is sort of percolating through. And obviously, as often, smaller is more realistic. So I think what can happen is that we get a basic income through so-called carbon tax and dividend. So the idea is we're going to tax carbon, which is something that every economist of no matter their party would strongly agree on. And then we take the revenue and we return it back to everyone as a sum of cash, no strings attached. Mm-hmm. So it's very much like a basic income. The amounts that we're talking about in plans that are currently on the table are not very large, yeah. but it's free cash for everyone. And this is a plan that's been supported by both conservatives and progressives and basically many of the former Fed Reserve chairs, including Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, have been signing on to support this plan, again, the carbon tax and dividend, whereby we tax carbon and we give the money back to the people in cash, no strings attached. So,
including me.
Yeah, right? Mm. And you.
for our drug habits, right?
Anyone, you know, there's no conditions. So that this is a way that it could happen on a small scale in terms of the amount. But, and you know, then we can take it from there. I'm very much interested in gradualism because this is something that we can take it small, see what happens, measure the effects, and then we can talk about whether we want to expand something like that. And I think the urgency also of the environmental problem commands also on that side that maybe we want to expand the kinds of essentially taxes on environmental harms in order to discourage this kind of behavior and thereby raise more money, which we can also return back to the people. So there's some sort of double benefit on discouraging harmful behavior while providing people with a source of income security.
Conrad, it looks like you're going to jump in there. Were you going to say something?
I'm going to ask Joanna if she thinks that when we study the brain, we should also start like very small and then only late build up a little bit.
Well, I mean, you know, who knows? But certainly if you don't understand the small things, I guess it's like, how can you
understand the big things?
I mean, obviously, this doesn't always apply. Sometimes it's easier to understand the phenomenon at a more micro level, and there can be a sort of no bridge. It's hard to go from the micro to the macro, which is something that I think Conrad has thought about in the context of the brain.
And lots of readers or listeners to Paul's podcast have heard about it.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So, and I just want to put in a plug, if you want to know more about basic income, check out my website. I have a whole review of the literature that tells you all about it and all the different tests that have happened that, you know, offer policies similar to basic income and all of their effects. So, you know, for the interested listeners, I direct them there.
Well, it'll definitely be a link in the show notes, but just to say it here, is it marinescu.eu, right?
Exactly. And follow me on Twitter.
It's a little frustrating for me. I used to be the one with the many Twitter followers, and Yona just overtook me.
That's what happens when you do relevant research.
Well, thanks for being on the show, guys. It's been fun. So what is monopsony and why are you interested in it? And then we can move on here.
Right. So that's another area that I've been working on a lot recently. So the idea there is just in thinking about how wages come to be what they are. So, you know, you might think, oh, surely people get a fair pay. And intuitively, basically, if you contribute more to your bottom line of your employer, surely you should be getting paid more or less as a proportion of how much you contribute. And that's basically what basic economic theory tells us, that if markets are perfectly competitive, and this is the rub, meaning that many employers compete for your services, then you're going to end up paying what you're worth, because basically if you're underpaid, some other employer would come and fetch you and pay you more. Mm-hmm. So eventually you'll be fairly compensated for, you know, what you bring to companies. And so the idea of monopsony now is that actually employers can underpay workers because workers don't have that many opportunities. It is not easy to move. There aren't that many other employers that you could be working for. For example, so many in our audience might be in the academic career. If you think about how specialized you are, the various geographic constraints that you might have in terms of where you'd be willing to live, there aren't that many options. And so what my recent work shows is that just looking at the whole US labor market, if you look at a market that is more concentrated, meaning that there's just a few employers that are currently recruiting in that market, this is a market that is going to tend to have lower wages as compared to a time where this market would have many employers operating in it. So, you know, for example, you might think about a small town. If they just have a Walmart in town, wages might be lower, says the theory, than if they had an equally many jobs in retail, but are maybe broken down between five or six smaller, you know, mom and pop stores. So because, again, and what you have to think about is the same number of jobs, but it matters how many employers control those jobs. You could have many jobs, but if all of the jobs belong to Walmart, there's not really competition for workers because ultimately all the jobs are controlled by Walmart. So that's sort of the idea of monopsony. And so we find again that an increase in concentration, meaning fewer employers that are active in the market, is associated with people getting paid less and, you know, plausibly getting paid less than what they deserve. And so this is very important right now because there are ways to address that through antitrust enforcement. So basically, there are all sorts of things that we can do legally to protect workers against behaviors by employers that worsen this problem, such as, for example, mergers. So if two employers merge with each other, now they have greater power over workers because they've just reduced the options that workers have in terms of what employers they could be working for. And that constitutes a basis for potentially blocking a merger. And mergers, big mergers, have to go through review by the federal antitrust authorities. And now they have an opportunity to block some of these mergers if we can foresee really negative impacts for workers who will see reduced competition for their services and therefore lower wages and lower opportunities for career advancement.
So you're increasing freedom with UBI and decreasing business freedom with your work on monopsony. So it's an
increasing workers' freedom and competition in the market.
So. Okay, cool. Okay, good. So that gives us a real flavor for what you do. Okay. At my own peril here, I'm gonna tell a joke. It's the joke of the week, and don't worry, it's not designed to make you laugh. So some of my listeners, for some reason, seem to like this. Okay, and then we're gonna talk causality. All right. So there's this married UPenn professors. These married UPenn professors, and they're planning their vacation to go ski with this podcast host in Durango, Colorado. And the woman says, "Huh, you know, I really hope it's going to snow right before we get there, so that the skiing is really good." And the man says, "Yeah, but you know, chaos theory, it's impossible to predict the weather that far in advance." And then their robot pipes up and says, "Oh no, I've got it. Let's see. Looks like it will snow a lot right before you get there. So oh, isn't that wonderful?" The man says, wait a second. Astounded, he says, "Wait a second. Are you telling me you've become so advanced in your deep learning algorithms that you can predict the weather that far in the future?" The robot says, No, of course not. Ever since I had that bad fall last spring, I can just feel it in my 412th and 413th hidden layers."
You're interviewing too many deep learning people.
I know. Well, it's the state of AI, so I get to put a little drum kick in there. So, all right. Hot off the press. Quasi-experimental causality in neuroscience and behavior research in Nature Human Behavior. And this is work with Patrick Lawler as well. You both co-authored the paper as well. So how did this collaboration come about?
So Joanna has been my wife, as you know, for about 15 years.
Not that collaboration.
Well, actually, it was kind of the same one. So in economics, people really worry about causality. And for good reasons, At the time when they weren't worrying about causality, they said a lot of stupid things. And then one day they basically told themselves that they wanted to get causality clean. Now, what do you want an economist to do? You want them to tell you what a policy would do. Would it increase GDP if we lower taxes? Well, maybe it wouldn't. But those are questions. There are real questions in economics. And there's a correct answer and a wrong answer about it. What's good in economics is we can find out if we're right, which is we do the experiment. So they realized for decades how important it is to obsess about causality. And for decades, they basically reworked the things they did to ask causal questions in a clean way. And therefore, economists like my wife constantly talk and worry and think about causality. So basically, I've been having dinner with causality every day of my life for the last 15 years or so. So in that sense, it's not very surprising that I get into causality. And then once I started seeing the things that the economists talk about in neuroscience, it was really eye-opening. And that's why it was great to get a real expert involved and write a paper about what opportunities there are to learn about causality.
I will add one more twist to this, which is that for economists, it's often very hard to do a randomized control trial because of the sort of policies that we deal with.
Like, one gives you enough money to decrease taxes just randomly to see what will happen.
So it's very rare and to have an actual randomized control policy experiment. That's not how it goes. So we had to try to get creative to find ways of making causal inference as if it were a randomized experiment, but by using different methods. And I think in some of the scientific domains, because RCTs are, pretty common and well accepted method, you go for that and, you don't necessarily think about, hey, there's these other options that you could be using. And so today also, I think with big data, that also opens the opportunity of exploiting those new options, because many of them will do much better if you use a lot of data, which, now.
But you still will need something like quasi-experts.
Obviously, but my point is, it's kind of a complementary process where the two together are more than the sum of the parts, so to speak.
So, but quasi-experiments is what the economists call an experiment is if they're randomized. So they give like the one treatment to half of the people, the other treatment to the other half of the people. Quasi-experiments, if you aren't doing that, but something is doing it, maybe Texas gives them like low taxes at some point of time, and maybe the next state gives a higher tax, and then Texas changes the tax rate, and then the Kansas changes the tax rate. And by looking at these things that aren't really random, but that have a certain random component, they like figured out techniques to tease apart how things causally work.
Well, that was going to be my question, is what is a quasi-experiment that you just defined? So just to be, totally clear for people. So let's just talk about causality in general for a few minutes, I suppose. I've been learning a little bit about causality through your paper, but also Judea Pearl's work. I mean, he's been at this for a long time. I think his most recent book is The Book of Why.
It's a beautiful book.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that too. It's interesting because he, speaking of artificial intelligence, he thinks that there are hurdles in AI that just won't be surpassed until we build causality into the systems. And okay, this is a silent thumbs up. That doesn't work on an audio podcast, but I can at least say that you're doing it. But I did read online. There's an available lecture that he gave in 1996 called "The Art and Science of Cause and Effect," and it's kind of just an interesting take on the history of causality. And he starts with Adam and Eve in the Bible and makes the point that causality is man-made in the sense that person-made, let's say, Ioana, so I don't want to offend anyone, so that God asked Adam what happened when Adam ate the apple. And Adam didn't just say, I ate the apple, he blamed Eve. So he added explanation, added some cause, right? And then Eve blamed the serpent. And God never asked them for explanation, just what happened. So in that sense, like, man created this causal notion. And so man started on this causality path. And later on, there were natural events that were considered to have natural causes, that, you know, God was doing everything, for example. And people would even, their lives would sometimes be in peril at the throw of a die or the casting of straws, right? The picking of straws, because God was causing the, let's say, a die to come up six. And that meant the sixth person gets thrown off the ship, right? That's how they determine their cause. And so it goes on and on in this long train of entertaining lecture. And it's just a couple of things. It's interesting that it's a problem that as humans, we only infer causation because we only experience and observe correlations, right? You know, when you hit the cue ball into the other ball, we can infer that the cue ball is making the other ball move. But all we see is like every time we do that, statistically, the probability is super high that one will follow from the other. And he makes the point that the word cause is not even in probability theory. And I won't go on and on about this particular tract, but I just kind of wanted to lay causation on the table and maybe ask you guys, you know, your thoughts about causation in general and the problems therein.
So I think, you know, in econometrics, in policy evaluations, or when we try to evaluate something like a policy, this notion of counterfactual is really fundamental. That's what we call the counterfactual, is the thing that would have happened if the cause wasn't operating.
Yeah.
So basically, to say that something is causal is to make some assumption about the counterfactual and then measure. So we are measuring, we're asking, you know, you have an outcome, let's say, you know, employment, because I'm an economist, and we want to ask what was the effect of this policy on employment. So then what we're asking is, you know, to phrase it more formally in the meaning of econometrics, we're asking, okay, so this policy happened, this is the level of employment we observe with the policy that has happened. What would have happened if the policy weren't there? That's the counterfactual. And then we measure the effect of the policy as the difference between what has happened and that we observe versus what the employment would be like without the policy, aka the counterfactual. Therefore, the big problem of causality is to find a way to fill in for that counterfactual, for the state of the world that we actually don't observe. That's why it's called a counterfactual, where the policy wouldn't have happened, so that then we can compare, you know, employment with the policy and without the policy. So that's sort of the fundamental problem of causal inference, is how do you construct a counterfactual, again, like, you know, to measure the outcome in the state of the world where the policy, whose inference you're trying to measure, didn't happen.
And to do so, taking into consideration all the potential confounds as well.
Exactly. So, you know, obviously the experimental method, so maybe Conrad, you can...
Yeah, so let's talk about confounds first. So one of the big problems, or the big problem in causal inference is confounds. Let's say we look at medicine, we might find that there's a treatment, and let's say we look at some outcome, maybe death. It's possible that people who are treated die less often, but that could have multiple reasons. It could be that the treatment makes people die less often, or it might be that rich people get the treatment and rich people happen to be dying less often. All of a sudden, socioeconomic status is a confounder for everything. And to immediately bring that to neuroscience, we have that confounder problem. Let's say I recall from two neurons. I find that many times when one neuron fires, a little bit later the other neuron fires. Well, that could be because that one neuron makes that other neuron fire. Or alternatively, it could be that there's some brain state. And when that brain state happens, well, then one neuron fires at some early time, and then the other neuron fires somewhat later within that. In the first case, there's like a real connection between them. It's like really one neuron makes the other neuron do something. In the other case, there's absolutely no interaction between the neurons.
So just to piggyback on what you just said, to get back to my counterfactual with these two neurons, if, you know, the case is that the one, let's say neuron A causes the reaction neuron B, then you should see that if neuron A does not fire, then your bee does not fire, at least statistically on average, you know, over a number of observations, you can see a difference between those two. Whereas if it's like a state of the brain, actually what's driving the behavior of both neurons has to do with that particular state of the brain. And, you know, it's not really that the one is influencing the other in a direct way, but it's this other hidden so-called omitted variable, we call it in econometrics, that is causing both of them to fire, but it's not that neuron A has a causal impact on neuron B.
But the important thing is that that reality exists, no? Like, Paul, the way you formulate it, in a way, made it sound as if causality is kind of something that you can have an opinion about. Like, at some level, there exists reality. So if I make a neuron fire, or if I make a neuron not fire, it will have an influence on other neurons. And at some level, causality, therefore, is perfectly cleanly defined counterfactually. It is, if I now would have stopped the neuron from firing, what would have happened differently? And when we randomize things, we can actually read that out. Now, like if we could say optogenetically activate the neuron or inactivate the neuron, we can actually measure the true causal effect, which exists.
Yeah, and has a one of the interesting things about causality is that it has a direction, whereas in mathematical equations and all the physical equations, they're all symmetric in that you can run them forwards and backwards and you get the same outcome, but causality, like time, seems to have a direction, like entropy.
Right. If you make the light go on, the light switch will not flick over.
Right.
And I also want to say that some questions seem hard to answer because there might be no data, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not an answerable question. So, for example, in history, that's a typical example. You might ask, is it the case that the Second World War was caused by the greedy powers that imposed huge financial sanctions on Germany? So you can say, like, is it the financial sanctions that caused the war? Now, you can't really make this a scientific study because there's not enough data. It's like you have only one observation.
Well, thank God.
Yes, but hypothetically, you could imagine many Germanys, you know, and in some cases the reparations happened, in some cases the reparations didn't happen. We forgave them and didn't give them a financial penalty. And if, you know, with this many parallel universes, the war would happen more often in the cases where reparations were asked from Germany, then you'd conclude that reparations have a causal impact on the Second World War. Except that in this case, it's a case where, practically speaking, you can't really do it, but hypothetically, you could.
Yeah. Well, so we're in a position right now where we could impose a counterfactual, potentially, right, and remove the alt-right and remove the current presidential regime and see what happens, right?
Exactly. Hypothetically. So we can create many USs and in all these parallel universes see what happens with and without, you know, the alt-right.
But I know eventually everything ends up with Hitler on the internet. I just want to bring us back to neuroscience. So at some level, the important thing, almost all the questions, all the real questions that we have in neuroscience have a causal connotation. Like, if there's a disease, the question I want to ask is, what should I change? Or what could I have changed so that the disease wouldn't have happened? When it comes to understanding, the whole language, the way we think about the brain is, how does a part of the brain, maybe a brain region, make something happen? How does it cause an effect? I don't care that it's correlated to the effect. I care that that brain region or the neuron or whatever, or the molecule is involved in something, make something happen. So almost every real question that we have in neuroscience is of a causal nature.
But we have, the old adage, correlation doesn't equal causation. You hear that over and over and over in neuroscience, and I don't know if you do in economics as well, but...
We don't even need to say it anymore, though. It's so absurd.
You don't. It's so ingrained in economics that it's... Okay, so Conrad, do you think that in neuroscience that it is still a kind of a problem, a widespread problem?
You've got to be kidding. It's a huge problem. It's everywhere. It's once you understand causality and the nature of causal inference, reading the neuroscience literature is really, really difficult. Every other paper claims causality without having a claim to that. And there's like tricks that people use for that. right. For example, when it comes to the analysis of networks in the brain, what you do is you say, have LFP recordings or fMRI recordings from some areas. Then you put it through an algorithm. It gives you a network. And all of a sudden, and there is this thing where we allow ourselves to call correlation causation, for example, through the trick of so-called Granger causality, where all of a sudden correlations become causality. And you find that in so many subdomains of neuroscience, for example, in tuning curve mappings, lots of people characterize how does a neuron respond to the outside world. That is a purely, there's a causal connotation where it's like, what is the causal effect of the stimulus on something happening in the brain? But there's no causal connotation of what that part of the brain does in computing or something. That's unsupported. Mm. But we use this like funny wording called representation or something, where all of a sudden our correlational finding, which is perfectly fine and interesting, becomes a causal role that because it's correlated to color, this must be an area that specializes in the causal role of extracting colors from images.
The last time you were on the program, Conrad, we talked about your paper where you guys developed an algorithm to try to detect image fraud. Now I'm wondering if in a few months I'm going to see a paper with an algorithm to detect false causality statements in neuroscience papers.
It turns out that we're actually working on that.
Get out of town. Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Okay, so what I mean with that is that the questions we want to ask in neuroscience are all causal. So there are papers that are humble about it, that say, here's a correlational finding. I think this is what it could causally mean, but I don't have evidence to claim that. And then there are other papers that use interesting linguistical constructs to basically allow them to go all in on the causal interpretation and basically ignore the problems that are there. There's this cool concept. Have you read that? There was this recent article. It's called Head Shifts. Mm-mm. Okay, this is great. So when people write a paper, it usually needs to make certain assumptions. Now, like you're basically, here's what I find, here's the set of assumptions. Under these assumptions, this is what it means. But if I then cite your paper that has all those hedges, I will no longer use that. Mm-hmm. And so that, the idea of head shifts is that because the hedges erode away, a whole field can basically move away from the truth by virtue of the hedges in the future no longer being relevant.
By assuming and referencing the same assumptions or hedges?
Exactly. By assuming that the hedges must have been true.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up. It's a single article. I'll link to it if I can find it.
I'll find it for you.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, in the paper, you guys describe three main techniques on how to go about doing this. And I thought maybe just to keep things kind of broad, one of you could just choose one of the techniques, or both of you can talk about it. Maybe your favorite example, and just describe it in a broad sense and maybe give an example of how it could be used.
Yeah, let me start with regression discontinuity, which is my favorite. So let's say we have a process that has a fixed threshold. In medicine, that could be I call you high blood pressure if your blood pressure is above 130 or something. In neuroscience, that could be, does a neuron spike? A neuron has a certain input drive. If that is above some threshold at some point of time, it will spike. Otherwise, it will not spike. Now, if we compare the times where the neuron spikes and the times where a neuron doesn't spike, everything is different. The network state is different. The stimulus is different. The response will be different, and so on and so forth. So the comparison of spiking versus non-spiking is pointless. In the same way, in medicine, if I have people that have low blood pressure versus high blood pressure, well, the high blood pressure people will be older and heavier and you name it. Now, the comparison is pointless. But here's the thing. If I take people that are very, very close to the threshold, let's say 129 versus 131, as I make that interval smaller and smaller, they must become identical. And the reason why they must become identical is because there's noise on the measurement of blood pressure, say. In the same way as there will be noise on like on the measurement of what the drive to a neuron is. So the important thing is those two groups, as we approach the threshold from both sides, the groups become identical. But if we have a difference, where could a difference be coming from? Well, if you're above the threshold, you spike. Or if you're above the threshold, you get the treatment for high blood pressure. So these two groups are identical by all other means, apart from the fact that one of them gets so-called treated, the other one doesn't. Like in economists speak, spiking is getting treated. And Then you can say, well, what is the downstream effect of that? I could look at what another neuron does or what a behavior does. And because of that construction, it gets under very harmless assumption, provably a correct estimator of the causal effect. Not of the overall causal effect, but what's called the local average treatment effect, which is how much does the spiking matter when we are in the state where we are really close to the threshold, if you use the neuroscience domain.
Or for blood pressure, for those people who are really close to the high blood pressure threshold, how much does it help those kinds of people to take the medicine that lowers blood pressure? It's local. We can't conclude about people who have super high blood pressure because these are not comparable. We're just comparing people who are very close to the threshold on each side.
And same thing with the spiking, basically. We can't universally say what the causal effect of a neuron is in the extreme case where it's blatantly obvious that it spikes based on the network state. Well, it will spike in any case, and therefore we can't disentangle that, so we can't know that. And regression discontinuity could be broadly used in neuroscience if you say intracellular recordings. Or if you're in a situation where you have a threshold phenomenon in some brain area, you could figure out what the brain area does. Whenever you have threshold processes, you can use those ideas.
Yeah, this was my favorite in the paper as well. Kind of the most intuitive to me, I think, as well. Do we want to talk about other ones, or?
I think we should talk about difference in differences.
Difference in differences is also
easier to come by. Like, RDDs can be hard.
So differences in differences comes from the following idea. Let's say there is a time that is, in a way, randomly chosen where a subgroup is treated. Let's say in economics, that could be that there is January 30th of 2014, some county changes its policy. The idea of different death is then you construct two groups. You construct the group that randomly get that shock, that change, and a group that didn't get that change. When it comes to neuroscience, that might say we have a local perturbation with optogenetics at some point of time.
Mm-hmm.
That is random by all, or like maybe a perturbation induced by some other brain area, something like that. We can then compare those two groups, and we can look if that one group has a different trend than another group, and that allows us to infer about causality again. The important thing here is we derive it from basically this perturbation happening for no reason that is in the population that we're looking at.
So another example from medicine, you could imagine, for example, one hospital introduces a new treatment at a certain date. The neighboring hospital hasn't done it yet. And then we compare the outcomes of patients in the two hospitals. So we look at them before and after the new treatment was introduced. And what in a experiment in a different and different setup that works well, the key assumption is that if it weren't for the treatment, the trends in the outcomes, let's say mortality for our patients, would be the same. So it's okay if one hospital, for example, has higher mortality than the other. That's okay with this method. What we want to see is that over time, they always track each other exactly. So the gap remains the same. The gap or difference tends to be the same over time. And then if the new treatment had an impact, then after the new treatment was introduced, the hospital that implemented it, the mortality went down, let's say, if it worked well. So then the gap narrowed. So that's why it's called difference in differences, because it's the difference between the two hospitals, that's one difference, compared after the treatment versus before the treatment. And I think a difference in differences method is something that can apply decently in many cases. So you're looking for a control group that is plausibly similar enough. It doesn't have to be the same, but just similar enough. But most importantly, is it follows the same trends. And the reason why it's useful that it's similar is that it's just then more plausible that the trends are the same. But really what we need is that the trends are the same. That in the absence of the policy, the whatever gap in outcome there is between, say, the two hospitals in my example I was saying earlier, it stays constant. Maybe both mortality goes up or both go down, but the gap has to remain constant. And again, if the characteristics of the two groups are very similar, you know, it's more likely, plausibly, that this difference would stay constant, but for the treatment. And that's where we get again to the counterfactual. You know, what would have happened if it weren't the treatment? The point is, in difference in differences, without the treatment, you want the difference between the control and treat group to stay constant over time. And so that's sort of how you can make conclusions that if something changed, so the difference between the two changed, that's plausibly due to the new treatment that was introduced at the one hospital, but not the other. And I think this method is applicable in many cases, because if you're a bit clever, you can come up in many, not all, with some plausible, you know, control group for your group of interest.
Okay, great. So those are two of the, so that's differences and differences, what you were just describing. And then before that was regression discontinuity design. And there was one other main one in the paper. Let's leave it at that, and I'll point to the paper so people can learn more. And I should say there are nice diagrams in the figures in the paper so that to illustrate this clearly for people, and with causal graphs included as well. So it's a well-written, of course, clearly written paper. So these techniques, and there are others too, the three main ones in the paper, and I know that there are others available. They can be used in a variety of situations. Are there, speaking of counterfactuals, I suppose, do you imagine situations in which techniques like this just don't have the reach, aren't going to cut it?
In the brain, there's lots of cases where it's hard to do any of them. So let's say we're in that situation where we cut not from all neurons in the brain, but from a whole bunch of them. In that case, every variable influences any of the others, potentially, and there are confounders. In fact, there are 10 to the 10 confounders, arguably, and we currently don't usually record from more than 10,000 neurons or something. So there's effectively an infinite number of confounders. Now, under those circumstances, none of the techniques from quasi-experiments can work. In fact, no technique for causal inference can work in mm-hmm. that domain. And the reason for that is simply that anything we do see among recorded dimensions could be arbitrarily mediated by things that we don't see. So we can never know it. And arguably, much of what we are trying to do in neuroscience at the moment is in that domain where we cannot get at causality like that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so valuable, the development of perturbation techniques. That's really moving very quickly ahead. All kinds of cool new optical perturbation techniques.
So yeah. I think part of the advancement of science is to get creative. So, you know, there are domains that where questions are hard to answer. For example, if you're asking what's the effect of a country's level of deficit on growth,
yeah.
That's super hard because every country is different. And if you compare one country with another country, there's many reasons why the outcomes, you know, could be different. It's millions of people and companies and so on acting. But, you know, for example, one way to make it a little bit better that people have used is, for example, instead of countries, looking at U.S. states. Because, and you know, their various aspects of their fiscal policy or the way they spend their money, because at least U.S. states, there's, you know, 50-something of them, and they're similarly, they're pretty similar, more similar than different countries. At least, you know, they have the same legal rules and so on. So we're putting ourselves in a better situation to at least do, for example, difference in differences by comparing states. And that's what I did, for example, with Alaska, looking at the universal basic income style that they have, comparing Alaska with other states, which was not difference in differences, but a related method. So that sort of allows us to take it one step further. But many questions are hard to answer. So then It's about being clever and talking about the big question, but finding a setting where you can reasonably give an answer that you can be confident enough about your causal inference, because in that domain, you can be sufficiently confident, even if it's hard to answer some of the very big questions, because again, like, there's a lot of variables that play at the same time in many of those big topics.
But I think we can explain to Paul how to very easily see it. So if we randomize things, then figuring out causality is easy. If we don't randomize things, if everything connects to everything else, we have no hope. We do have hope if there is someone who moves the lever in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. At some level, the thresholds that we have is a way where, like, someone, which is that threshold, is moving the lever. So quasi-experimental techniques will generally be useful if there's, like, a small number of, like, actors of some generalized way that kind of, like, somewhat randomly execute their policy, or where there's aspects that are locally as good as random. So when it comes to, say, how the news media work, it will be extremely difficult. Not like how Twitter works. Like, you economists aren't going to build a model that predicts which celebrity is going to trend tomorrow. Right.
But, you know, I do want to say about RCTs and the established causality, the interesting thing is that they tell us that the policy has an effect, but it doesn't tell us why necessarily. So, like, if the policy is a complicated policy that has many different aspects, just from doing the experiment, we don't know which aspect of that policy did the job. And so that's why I think there's a good complementarity between doing correlation and studies and more, you know, quasi-experimental, even experimental, because the correlation studies, while to be taken with a grain of salt, can allow us to have ideas to test out about certain mechanisms that might be at play, and then find a setting where we can reasonably establish causality for that mechanism. So I don't think that correlation studies are at all to be thrown away. It's just like you have to be careful that you cannot conclude to causality from a correlation study, but it can suggest plausible causal mechanisms. Like, people who are careful will say so. You know, this suggests that this might be going on. And then it's a first step that then you can take further and try to look for a context where you can test that out in a more experimental or quasi-experimental way.
So correlation studies then could be seen almost as a roadmap to finding where you can start probing causal, like the little local areas where you can start asking causal questions.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a problem, which is that can be a fig leaf, you know, like, where basically everyone runs correlational studies without much certainty about what they mean, but it's fine because it's just inspirational or something.
Right, but it's a matter of balance. And I think to some degree in certain subfields of economics, we've gone so far as to not accept very interesting correlational studies at all. Like, we don't want to hear about it.
And I think that's a mistake. So on the other end.
And I think that's a mistake, because I think we can learn a lot from correlational, especially when they're carefully and thoughtfully done, you know, without overclaiming, we can learn a lot. But my field in some sub areas of economics has gone so far as to say, if it's not an experiment or a quasi experiment, I don't even want to hear about it.
And you've been brainwashing me.
A little bit. Right?
Well, so you guys will be the Hitlers of correlational studies in neuroscience. Okay. So I think that's a pretty good summary of the work, and gives people a lot to chew on. One of the things I've been enjoying about doing the podcast recently is that what I'm hoping that it's doing for people is just giving them another something else to start thinking about and incorporating into their thoughts as they move forward in their own scientific endeavors here. So I really appreciate it. We're coming short on time, but would you guys mind answering a few sort of more general, broad questions here?
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, I'm fine.
I'm good.
Okay. Just off the top, what book or resource would you recommend to learn more about causality? We talked about Judea Pearl's The Book of Why.
I love The Book of Why. I love his older book called Causality, if I remember that right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one view on causality.
Right.
It's a very stats-minded way of thinking about causality is beautiful. I love it. But I must say that the mostly harmless econometrics book by Angrist and Peschke is also beautiful. Yeah.
So Joshua Angrist at MIT has two books that I recommend to people. One is Mostly Harmless Econometrics and Mastering Metrics. And they are both, you know, a good, pretty solid, kind of mid-level introduction to these topics. It's not intro, so, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend if you never heard of statistics and so on. It's a good level if you know things and you want to tool up and understand what's going on in econometrics.
I think that's my audience. It's a pretty educated audience, so...
Mastering Metrics, I think, is very readable.
Yeah, so Mastering Metrics is a little more, you know, accessible.
I think to start with the combination of Book of Why and Mastering Metrics is a great, great beginning.
Okay, good. So just to talk about causality just a bit more, not really causality, but like I said, you know, Judea Pearl makes the point, and I won't say his name more often in the podcast, but that AI is really hindered by not having causality built into the systems, right? That it's all basically statistics and probabilities right now, that it's all curve fitting and pattern matching. So for example, a machine would be able to correlate the appearance of fever with malaria, but wouldn't be able to suggest that malaria causes fever, right? Is one example that he gives. So the question is, do you think that religion as a judging and creating and causing God, that aspect of religion, do you think that'll ever go away?
That's an interesting question. Why would it be a good thing?
Well, it seems the progress of increasing information and knowledge, human knowledge, so we infer causes less and less to third parties, gods, deities, etc., more and more to natural events, right? So
that's interesting, but you know, I think to me, religion is less about causes and more about meaning, you know, and I think those things are different. You know, it's one thing to know kind of mechanistically what causes something, and this is something that Cara and I work a lot on, but it's a different issue to talk about the meaning of things, and that is intimately related with values. So what we value. So causality is very much what you can call it to be the domain of the positive line of or scientific line of inquiry about what is. And I think a lot of religion has to do with what ought to be, what is meaningful or valuable. And this is something that science has nothing to say about in any direct way. And so, I don't really think that, certainly in the current state of affairs, there's any conflict between more causality and the place of religion. Maybe early on, because religion was making all these, like, encompassing claims about what's going on, but we've moved on from that, you know, very far away. And I think nowadays, the religion, again, is more about the meaning and the values, and not so much about explaining, you know, the world in that causal way. So,
yeah, and the times where God was the cause maker, it comes from the time of, like, the ancient weather religions.
It's still around, though. It's still present.
It might still be resonating a little bit, but I don't think for a lot of people today, God is the causer of physics anymore. I think God is something much more human now. No, it's something about the way we think.
Oh,
and it's something that has relations with us, as opposed to something that makes the mechanics work.
This could really go into a long discussion here. So we'll just curtail it, I suppose. But yeah.
Well, we'll be back to the show.
I know. Don't worry. We'll be back next week. I just realized, too, that I think the last time we spoke, I must have been in a halfway between when I was living in an RV and in our new house. So I don't think I had this studio. So we've had a lot of change here. I don't know what caused it, but we had a lot of change.
What's the counterfactual?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm going to work this out after the show before we speak next. So What role do you think embodiment will play, if any, using AI to understand our brains?
So I think the bodies that we have a huge influence on the kinds of problems we need to solve. And the kinds of problems we need to solve, I think, have a huge influence on the way we think. And when it comes to the role of bodies, I can just mention Malcolm McIver's work, which is beautiful, where he's conceptualizing the roles of animals as a function of how their sensory system works. So he works with a weakly electric fish and nicely highlights how for different animals, the part of the world that they can sense is very different. And therefore also the way they deal with information from the world is very different. So if you can only sense the immediate vicinity of your body, then there's like little reason to carry really complicated theories with you. Hmm.
Right, so arguably, basically, the further you can see and the more there's reasons to plan and think ahead because you can see those things. So, you know, it's about seeing. If you have only a very, you know, immediate perception, arguably it is less useful or feasible to start to have planning thoughts.
Yeah, I've been thinking, I've been learning more about interoception and the role that that plays in our moment-to-moment awareness and what it could mean within the realm of consciousness and higher order cognition. So,
oh, very interesting.
Conrad, I know that you are a collaborator extraordinaire, and this latest work was a collaboration with, somehow you collaborated with someone you know in economics. And the last time you were on the show, you talked about how important it is to play and to experiment with different avenues of learning and topics. What do you think, this is a question for both of you, what do you think the right balance is between collaboration among like-minded and near topic and otherwise folks, between that and sort of solo deep focused study on, you know, the depth of a single topic and exploring like less related topics? Is there a right balance there, do you think, that you would recommend for people?
I see the value of both of them. So I have a good number of collaborators who choose a relatively narrow set of topics, but they have this just like incredible, fantastic, deep knowledge about absolutely everything happening there. And these people, in a really important way, carry the knowledge of mankind. They carry what is known in that area. I think it helps for progress to also have people that are a bit like me and to some level, Jana, just as well, that are linked into these different traditions and these different intellectual sources and can like highlight how certain combinations are really promising for the future. So in that sense, I think what we have at the moment might be quite good, that there are some people who try to build the bridges, some people who really focus deeply, but my hunch is that the way the system is structured, it makes it harder for the people who build bridges. So there are a couple of more senior, super, super successful bridge builders. But if I see young PhD students who build bridges or postdocs, it's often career-wise harder for them than the people who take one field and focus on that. And that might be holding us back from some interesting bridges that could be built that aren't being built.
Yeah, I really agree. I think part of it is a personality trait, like sort of what are you happy with as an individual? If you're more collaborative, you know, as a personality, etc., then it might be a good way to go for you to build those bridges. And I agree with Conrad that when you're starting out, it's often dangerous to, you know, for example, write in too many different topics, even worse disciplines. And that's because of the, and that's where I'm an economist, I think about the incentive structure, meaning the rewards that you get the job as an academic. And so for young people, ultimately, for example, they need to get tenure, which means they're going to get letters from, you know, older experienced researchers that testify to the importance of their work. And usually, and that's in a way a good thing, people want to speak to something that they understand well. So if someone has a lot of work in very different areas and you ask another scholar who specializes in one particular area to talk to you about the importance of this person's work, they say, well, they wrote one paper in my area. It's pretty good. I can only talk to that one. So therefore, it seems like their contribution is a little bit lost, or it's hard to get someone else to explain to you why, you know, this person's contribution is very important. That's why it's very oftentimes very risky as a young person to in science to go too many, you know, different directions. So I'd say if you're at least you want to have a core. Like, you know, there might be a periphery of other things, but it's good to have a core of like highly specialized, you know, work that is in a particular area. And frankly, Conrad, I think you have benefited
from that. So basically up to tenure, I was running with this Bayesian motor control thing. I was like clearly the man for that. And then once I passed that threshold, I was like, whatever.
Well, so I had John Krakauer on the show a few weeks ago, and one of the things that he advocates is, you know, even for graduate students and everyone really, is taking a day and just going to the library and not randomly, but looking in different areas and exploring, right? So, and I recently read a book called Make It Stick. It's a book about the latest.
John Heath and Keith Heath or something.
Yeah, a really good book. And one of the things that they have talked, that they say has improved learning is this concept of interleaving, which is you sort of move on from topic to topic and come back. So you have multiple strands going on kind of, but slowly move between them. And that actually improves the process of learning. And I would imagine improves creativity as well. I don't know what you think about that.
For people, I would also recommend judiciously use Twitter. Is also a great way to expand your knowledge and come up with new ideas that are maybe a bit different from what you usually do. And just like it just so refreshes my brain and gives me new ideas and new directions. So I really recommend sort of following other academics in your field and related fields. That's why, you know, it's easier on Twitter because the cost of interaction is so low. You know, you're not going to go to a conference that's in a field that's too different from yours. But you can follow two or three, you know, really interesting people in that field, and it gives you some idea of what they're doing. And who knows, maybe an interesting thought will pop out and you can think, oh, I can actually bring something to this question that they're talking about.
And read that crazy causality stuff by Joanna and Conrad,
for example.
Yeah. Okay, this is a great place, I think, to ask you just a few newlywed questions, and then I'm going to let you go because I don't want to take more of your time. So this is not specifically a newlywed question, but who uses Twitter more judiciously? Speaking of judicious use of Twitter.
I think we're both doing that pretty well.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we have the same number of followers, more or less, and we've been on it for a similar period of time. I think we're kind of mirrors of one another.
Yeah, don't get into fights.
But yeah, exactly. Don't feed the trolls.
Don't feed the trolls. Yeah.
Yeah. So like try to be measured in what you say. And even so, sometimes people will complain, but the more you come out with like, you know, crazy statements, or not necessarily crazy, but like very opinionated takes, and the more you're going to get into
I would never tweet something that I wouldn't feel comfortable saying at the next battle.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think that's the average user experience, but okay. So the way the newlywed game worked, if I remember correctly, is so I ask, let's say I ask Joanna a question about what Conrad's would think about something, right?
Okay.
So
and then what do I say?
And then if you match, then you should get married, or you should stay married. Is the thing?
Okay.
Okay. What do you think? So Joanna, I'll start with you. So what do you think Conrad's weirdest quirk is?
I'd say it's his tendency to pick up his phone whenever there's even a second of dead time in any activity.
It's a weird thing.
Well, I find it a little weird because I'm...
What would your answer be, Conrad?
It's much weirder that I like playing with anything. I like playing with ideas. I like playing with things. I think relative to most other people, everyone's using their phones all the time. That's not a distinguishing character.
Okay, but guys, let's keep it friendly.
I play with ideas more than other people. So, boo.
Okay. Maybe what I answer is what annoys me the most.
I didn't want to go down that road.
And you answered what you hate most.
I'm keeping it friendly here, so. Okay, so then we'll reverse this one, and then I'll just ask one more. How about? So Conrad, what do you think Ioana's weirdest quirk is?
What Ioana's weirdest quirk is?
I can see he's playing with this idea right now.
Yeah, that's all her quirks by now are no longer weird.
Oh, yeah, right.
Let's see, her weirdest quirk. She...
For the listeners at home, Ioana's really eyeing Conrad hard right now.
Ioana, really, like, anything we do together can be more meaningful if it can be combined with at least 3 minutes of salsa in some way.
Okay. Does that match up with your answer to the question, Ioana? Hmm.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, again, for me, remember, it's even harder to answer this question because of a counterfactual problem. It's hard to imagine not being myself and asking myself, what's weird about myself?
Of course, but that's the whole point. Well, actually, but you should think of game theory and think, what would Conrad say is the weirdest thing? That's how you win the game, right?
Yeah, so, sure. But you know, he's a bit in the same position, having been with me for a while. He no longer remembers the counterfactual.
But you must say that's kind of a totally tenable weird quirk thing.
Sure, but it's, you know, not necessarily like super prominent, unlike your phone checking.
Okay, this one will be more straightforward here. Okay, so maybe Conrad, we'll start with you first here. So who do you think Ioana's scientific hero is? If she had to pick a scientific hero.
Ioana's scientific hero. I think Ioana thinks Angrist is pretty damn cool.
True.
Is that right? Yeah. Oh, very good.
For sure. Aha! High five! Like number one on the not getting divorced.
It's definitely, I don't have ones, and it's one of the, therefore, good answer. So, what is Conrad? Like, this guy whose name escapes me because it's a rare name, but in your 10, or like your 10 ethical rules, there's someone's rules. And like, don't work on something that someone else could come up with if only they had the time.
Oh, yeah. That's Dijkstra.
Right.
Yeah, Dijkstra is awesome. Yeah, no, Dijkstra definitely could be one of them.
All right, congratulations, guys. I'm glad that I have caused your marriage to become stronger through this process. Okay.
Thank you.
Mine is the weird quirks, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, Conrad,
you should never lose an opportunity to incentivize your husband to do the right things by pointing out publicly to his failings.
Yeah, Conrad, you may now check your phone.
No, just kidding. He's actually the awesomest ever. And I think every day how grateful I am to have him.
Oh, la, la. And you too.
What a note to end it on. Okay, so I'll see you next week. Thanks for being here this week. And, no, seriously, appreciate it, guys. Appreciate the time.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Thank see you. You.
Brain Inspired is a production of me. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling $2 or $4 per month. Go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to the website braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help keep this show going without any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stereo.